Tonight it is my great pleasure to welcome again, and I'm not sure how many times it's been that we've had the pleasure of Dr. Amadeo's presence and wisdom here at Many Rivers Books and Tea, but it's been several, and we are delighted to have him here for the occasion of this latest book, Dancing with Fire. As many of you know, he had two well-received earlier books that we have here, right here on the table for you to see, Love and Betrayal, and Avant la Carte. And it is my great pleasure to welcome Don Amadeo back to Many Rivers Books and Tea. Please welcome him.
Thanks so much. Feels very honoring to be here. Feels good to be here talking about the book that I worked on for 10 years, really a labor of love for me, working on it for so long, just to really try to craft a book that would talk about how we need to integrate our spiritual life with our longing for intimate connections. I think we need to do both in our life. We both long for spiritual awakening, but I find that many people who are on a path of awakening, somehow their relationships don't thrive. There's difficulty in intimate relationships. Have you noticed anybody who has that challenge? None of us, of course. There was an interesting Mervyn Field poll, and he did a survey of California drivers. He found that 95% of drivers experience themselves as good or excellent drivers. But only 50% of people experience other people as good or excellent drivers. So it's an interesting picture. So what do you conclude from that? We have a very inflated view of ourselves as a driver, yeah? How good our skills are. So I think it's interesting to compare that to how we see ourselves in terms of how we conduct ourselves in intimate relationships. Often we have a very positive view of ourselves and we think it's the other person who's doing it wrong. Does that make sense? Because we don't like to do is to acknowledge our part in the conflict, what our role is. Maybe there's something we're doing that's contributing to difficulty in our relationship. What a concept, yeah? Not to shame ourselves, so it's a fine line between taking responsibility for how we might grow in certain ways to improve the quality of our relationship. Certainly, criticizing ourselves is not going to help. But just to be aware that there are some things that we might be able to do to bring more connection into our relationship. So I've been a marriage and family therapist for over 30 years now. And a lot of people come in, couples come in, and they tell me that they have a communication problem. They're having trouble with communicating. And they're right. But more fundamentally, what I'm noticing is they're having trouble with their own mindfulness practice, with their own self-awareness of what they're really experiencing inside. That they're not really aware of the subtleties, the subtle nuances of their felt experience. What they more tend to do is to judge others, analyze the other person. They share their perceptions of the other person with me in the therapy session. What the other person is selfish or self-centered, or they have issues with their mother, or things like that. But what they don't do is they don't share their vulnerability. They don't share their sadness, their hurt, their fears, their shame with each other. It takes a tremendous courageous vulnerability to connect with what we're really experiencing inside and then show that to each other. I mean, that's the basis for connection, is to show our felt experience to each other. So why is that so difficult? We're not aware often we're not aware of our feelings. We're not aware of what we're actually experiencing inside. And I find people in the spiritual community often use their spirituality to avoid getting connected to what they're actually feeling. And I want to jump right into reading one of my passages here in the book here to exemplify this. I'll try not to read too much because I know that can get boring, so if I'm reading too much you can stop me, okay? But this is a great story. I kind of found this toward the end of writing the book and I just immediately put it in toward the beginning of the book. A Chinese Zen story portrays a common pitfall of the spiritual path. A devoted old woman supported a monk for 20 years. She built a hut for him and brought him food every day. Wondering what progress he had made, she sent a beautiful young girl, rich in desire, to visit him and instructed her to embrace him and report back his response. That's every man's worst nightmare, right? No, not exactly. Okay. The young seductress visited the monk and without hesitation caressed him and asked, "How do you feel?" It's not fair, right? Standing utterly stiff and lifeless, he replied poetically that he felt like a withering tree on a rock in winter, totally without warmth. Hearing of the monk's heartless response, the old woman was quite displeased. "Do you think I fed that fellow for 20 years? Concluding that he was a fraud, she straightaway evicted him and burned down his hut. Zen stories are always very dramatic. Right? Has to be some kind of havoc in the story. So the monk's chilly response seemed to convey that he had transcended desire, but the old woman recognized he had merely replaced one desire with another. He was now clinging so tightly to meditative absorption that he dissociated from his human feelings and longings. Here we see the common hazard of denying our fiery desires rather than finding peace with them. And I don't know how many of us here have done that, maybe earlier or maybe now in our spiritual practice. We just thought we saw desire and longing as a problem, something to be transcended, right? Whereas it doesn't really work so well, does it, to try to transcend desire? Because otherwise we get very attached to the desire to get rid of desire. And we just get further and further away from what we're actually experiencing inside. So there's no way around it. We have to learn how to engage with our desires, how to engage with our longings, what I would call sacred longings, and find a path that works to connect us and that leads toward more connection and happiness and intimacy rather than more pain and suffering. So I say here, life is a dance with fire. Trying to extinguish human passions rather than dancing with them, propel them underground where they soon returned with a greater ferocity in the form of a firestorm that destroyed the monk's home. We can also imagine if he had surrendered to the young woman's seduction, he might have faced a different peril, becoming attached to an unaccustomed pleasure, allowing himself to fall in love and then facing love's potential loss. So there's no escaping life and the longings that are hinged to it. Life invites us to give desire its proper due and engage with it in ways that nourish us rather than sabotage us. So any comments or feedback? How do you feel? How does that sit with you, that story? Yeah.
Oh, it's a very interesting, surprising ending story.
Burning the hut down?
Yeah, it seemed like he couldn't win either way, whatever
he was going to do. He was in a tough spot, huh?
Yeah. But you gave us two options at the end. You said we could either embrace the desires, or we could deny the desires, or embrace them. And in certain spiritual traditions, they give a third option, which is to transmute them. Mm-hmm. Would you like to address that?
Well, I think that is, I think that they get transmuted in the process of being with them. If we can, and this is where focusing, some people know focusing, that Eugene Genlin developed, and Bruce Gibbs over here teaches focusing workshops. He actually has a flyer over here before I forget to mention it. He's a good teacher of focusing. But focusing is part of that path where you just simply be aware of your bodily felt experience just as it is. Mm-hmm. And in the process of being with it, things tend to open up, they shift, things unfold, we get a clearer sense of what those feelings might be trying to tell us about our life. And it's a path of really, so the feelings might transmute, they might give us messages about how to live more fully. It might transform our life in a certain way if we listen to those feelings and how they're moving us forward.
Well, I'm thinking more in terms of energy, prana, life force. Certain yogic traditions talk about redirecting them in meditation as a way of consciously allowing them to be transmuted.
I'm not going to address it too much. I think that's a path. It's a different path than I described in the book, because my concern with people working with that exclusively, I think if you complement it with what I'm talking about in the book, it could work. But I find people could use that every time they have a feeling coming up, they try to transmute it into something that's kind of transcendent.
Mm-hmm.
And you can lose the richness of how that feeling might be moving you toward, for example, if the feeling comes up in a relationship,
mm-hmm.
it might be important to communicate that feeling to the other person as a way to connect, as a way to be seen more. So I'm like contrasting the book like a vertical spirituality where you're transcending versus a more kind of horizontal spirituality where you're really connecting, you're sharing your experience just as it is. And that creates a climate where connection is more likely to happen.
I want a clarification that when you talk about connecting, are you, the connecting does not necessarily entail identifying with the emotion, right?
There's a certain kind of a spaciousness around the emotion. That's the ideal way. So you're not merging with the emotion.
So in the case of the monk,
right.
The monk, you know, what you're advocating is that the monk could be present to and acknowledge the humanness of the response that organically would arise in him, and yet not necessarily have to become identified with that emotion.
I talk about it more toward the end of the book. I don't want to give away the answers, but you're leading in that direction, though. But yeah, the path would be for the monk perhaps to notice the desire, and maybe the response would, and not necessarily act on the desire, just be with it, notice it, say, oh, you know, yes, you're a very attractive woman, and yes, it feels really lovely to be touched, but you know, I'm a monk, and my practice is to not be physically, to be sexual, to be physically engaged, but you know, maybe he could learn how to give a warm hug. Is that part of the practice? Could that be part of your practice?
So
a warm hug without it being a sexual thing. But he's in his body, he's present, he's connecting.
So your point is that the to the extent that the monk said that I'm a
withering tree in winter,
on
a rock in winter.
You take that to mean that he's actually identified with the rejection of,
I think he's identified with pushing away something that's a threat, right.
Okay.
I mean, you could try this with your partner. Next time you're touched, you might say that and see how it goes. How do you feel, honey? Well, I'm glad you asked.
That
I feel like a withering...
That usually leads to fire.
Leads to fire. But it might not go over too well. You could try it. So... moving on. So the things I'm addressing, I'll just read this too from the book. How can we develop an emotionally aware and interpersonally engaging intimacy? That really says it. That says what the book is about. How to develop an interpersonally engaging intimacy where we share our feelings, share our life. And how can we integrate our spirituality into our daily life in the world? And how do our relationships transform as we bring mindfulness to them? And how can we engage with our desires and longings in a way that deepens love, enhances intimacy, and fosters liberation? I mean, that's really an integrated path. What is a path toward... It sounds good, huh? You like it? A path where we're engaging with our desires, noticing what they are, working with them, hearing what they're trying to tell us, which ones to act on that are going to lead to more connection and joy, which ones are going to lead to more suffering and heartache. It takes a lot of experience to open to that, to engage with that. You familiar with Martin Buber?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love him.
You love Martin Buber? Yeah. Do you know how he... You familiar with I and Thou? Do you know how he developed that book and his work? A student came to him once in distress while Martin Buber was meditating, praying, and Martin Buber listened to him politely and wasn't fully attentive, and the student left and ended up killing himself. Yeah. So it really kind of awakened Martin Buber to realize he hadn't been fully present with this person, and so that's what led him to develop his life in terms of developing a relational kind of spirituality. That's why he wrote the book I and Thou, me and you, connecting. The importance of connection in spiritual life became his spiritual path to to promote that, to teach that. And there's a similar story from the Dalai Lama. Any of you familiar with the Dalai Lama? In Sebastopol.
Never heard of him.
I think I should read this one. I might not give it true justice. The Dalai Lama exemplifies a spiritual seeker who has no pretenses about transcending his humanity. Because I think that's what a lot of people do in the spiritual path. They try to transcend their humanity. He was asked by an interviewer if there's anything in his life that he regretted. What do you think he might have said? No, I don't regret anything. What is, I accept everything as it is, I've transcended all that. No, he didn't say that. He recounted the story of an older monk, I'll just say the story, of an older monk who was interested in this advanced esoteric practice. And the Dalai Lama came back and said, well, you know, that's really a very rigorous practice, it's more appropriate for younger people, I'd recommend a different kind of practice for you. So the monk left, and he killed himself so he could be reincarnated as a younger man and do this practice. Not recommended. So he was asked by the interviewer, how did you get rid of the regret? How did you get rid of the feeling of regret? What do you suppose he responded to that? What?
You don't.
Right. He didn't get rid of it. And that's what his response was. But before he responded, he paused a long time, which I find really interesting. Because to me, when he was pausing, that's like he was doing focusing. You know, he was slowing down, he was going inside, he was kind of struggling with it a little bit maybe, getting clear what the feeling was there. And then his response was, I didn't get rid of it. I thought that was a courageous vulnerability on the part of the Dalai Lama. I mean, to me, this is an amazing story of a very advanced spiritual practitioner who's honoring his humanity, honoring his vulnerability. That's one reason I love him so much. He's a great role model for embracing our humanity, not thinking that we have to transcend. So our relationships, our life could become much deeper if we did the same thing. If we took time to pause, go inside, notice how we're feeling about things, especially in relationships, because things happen really rapidly often in relationships. Feelings come up. We tend to attack, we blame, we get defensive, we stonewall, we kind of shut down the conversation because we feel it's a threat. How wonderful would it be if we could just pause, take some time, go into our body, notice what's coming up in our actual felt experience and share that with each other. And when I see couples in my couples therapy sessions doing this, it's very magical. Magical things happen. Connection begins to happen when two people can take the risk to really be vulnerable, really be open to what they're feeling and express that. So I find this story interesting, not even so much for what the Dalai Lama said, but for what the Dalai Lama didn't say. What didn't he say in response to that question, in response to that issue of this person killing himself?
It's his own comment.
Right, exactly. Right. How often do any of us, I mean, consider whether you say that to other people sometimes. It's, you know, that's your karma. That's his karma. What other kind of things might we say? It was his time to go, right. It was his decision to kill himself, right? I mean, he could have said that, right? It was his decision, it's not my responsibility, right? Kind of like the Fritz Perls kind of prayer. Fritz Perls, I'm not in this life to live up to your expectations. But that's a very cold way to live. We affect each other. I mean, we affect each other. So he didn't say that. Isn't that curious that he didn't say that? That kind of new age kind of thing? It drives me a little crazy. Does that drive anybody else kind of crazy when people say that?
Yep.
Does it? Yeah? Some of you might say that, so I don't want to ask too much. But I mean, there's some truth in it. I mean, we have a lot of responsibility that we can impart in our life. But often I think things are kind of co-created. It's like two people participating in the realities that emerge in our life. So the Dalai Lama didn't offer rationalizations to minimize the pain of this traumatic event, such as it was his decision to kill himself, or he created his own reality for himself. And how often do we hear people say that? Does that drive you? Is that just me, or does that drive you crazy too?
Totally nuts.
It drives you totally nuts. Not just me. Okay. I mean, there's some truth in it, right? There's some truth in it.
Probably.
We make choices. We make choices that contribute to what happens. Mm-hmm. But it's just not. But it's missing a lot. It's a very limited belief system. I think we use that belief to kind of comfort us and not take responsibility fully. So he created his own reality, and it's kind of heartless, isn't it? Instead of just feeling the sadness of this man killing himself, and you said something that might have contributed to that. I mean, to have feeling about that is very human, right? So I said, while there may be elements of truth in these beliefs, our own choices, words, and actions affect others' hearts and contribute to their decisions. And here's the main point. We're in this life together. We affect each other. We affect each other. Does that make sense? It might seem obvious, but often we have these beliefs where we don't live as if we affect each other. We distance, we detach, we isolate. And I talk also in the book of how I see the second noble truth, the cause of suffering in Buddhism. I see that as isolation, disconnection. The fact that we're so isolated, we're so disconnected from ourselves, from each other. I think that's really the cause of suffering. If we can really connect with what is, connect with our own feelings, connect with our own heart, our own life, and share that with each other, then we feel this connection. We no longer suffer so much. We're no longer so isolated. It becomes like a kind of a dissociating from our feelings. So I'm going to pause just a moment there. Any comments on that story and how that sits with you? Yeah.
Well, I could imagine the Dalai Lama pausing because, I mean, obviously if he has a regret about it, he feels some responsibility. He feels that his connection with this person, he should have said something more besides it's for a younger person, but don't go kill yourself or be present or something like that. But maybe he paused so long because he's worried about...
Oh, he didn't pause with the person who asked to do this practice. He paused in response to the...
Right.
Psychiatrist who was interviewing.
Right, no, he paused with the interviewer because he's like, oh God, last time I gave some advice, the guy killed himself. I better think about this pretty carefully because people take my words very seriously. And if I say I've lost all my regret, maybe he'll think suicide is the way to go. I don't know. I'm just imagining that once you start down that road of what I say, other people... You know, am I responsible for their actions? The part of the truth is, of course not. That's his reality. That's his decision. On the other hand, when you're in a position of power or you know, giving advice.
Yeah, it could be. It's hard to know what the Dalai Lama was contemplating there when he was pausing. Yeah. Anything else occur to anyone else around that?
I was wondering about boundaries, and there's all this stuff about, you know, taking on somebody else's. You know, if you address that.
Boundaries.
Yeah.
You taking on other people's stuff?
Yeah, and like being responsible because somebody did something. And
right. You have a whole section of boundaries in my authentic heart book, I think, so I don't address it too much in here.
All right.
But I think it's a really important issue, having certain kind of boundaries. And I think part of it is simply knowing what we're experiencing. So I have another story here. Oh, sorry, yeah.
Like when he said he has his regret, like that's a huge, we don't know what he has his regret. But I mean, like you can't just take that as that superficial two words. And he regrets this man had that kind of pain. He regrets that life is like that you go out and have these expectations. He regrets, I mean, it's huge. So it's not just a personal feeling that he's talking about. I mean, I heard the Dalai Lama talk. And, you know, you say, well, how often do you meditate? And he meditates the whole darn day. You know, he's eating. I mean, he has a huge way of responding that is inclusive of his feelings and the other person's experience.
Right. That's a huge thing.
Yeah. In my experience.
Uh-huh.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
So he's not just saying, well, I regret it because I said something. It's more like, I regret the whole human condition.
Maybe he's saying, I regret the whole human condition.
That's what I would think he would be saying.
Maybe. I hear it as something that's more personal in his heart, that he feels badly about
it's
it.
Also that.
Yeah, also that's it. Yeah, it could be both, exactly. But I just love the humanity of the Dalai Lama. I mean, at one point, the Dalai Lama said, I can be patient with children for short periods only.
Mm-hmm.
That's really embracing his humanity, right? I can relate to it, so I like that was good. And when someone asked him what his flaws are, and he says he's very attached to his prayer beads. And that sometimes he dreams about beautiful women. And then he has to remind himself that he's a monk.
My favorite Dalai Lama story like that is he was at some meetings in New York, and he got shuttled back and forth to these meetings down Fifth Avenue every day. He said after a while he found himself wanting things that were in the windows of the shop. He had no idea what they did for, but they were just so pretty he wanted them.
That's a good story. That's a good story. Okay, to move on here. I think I'll read this. You want a little entertainment? Entertaining story? Okay. This is in chapter one. I've never been a great meditator. A great meditator can sit for an hour in the morning and an hour in the evening, very still, back straight. A great meditator rises at dawn, bright and early, bright-eyed and alert, eager to hit the cushion before a grueling day at the office. There's no grumbling when the mornings are cold, traffic is bumper to bumper, and the hot coffee is not ready upon arrival. Everything is an opportunity for spiritual practice. If you're a great meditator, then all day long you watch your thoughts and you don't let them interfere with being here now. You never have judgments about other people, including your boss, who just promoted a younger, less qualified employee to the position you wanted. Any disappointment is brief because you know that desire and ambition create suffering. Besides, you're so compassionate that you're happy for him as you figure he needs the raise more than you do. Your life is blessedly serene, no worries that the polar ice caps are melting, and that your elderly parents are running out of money and want to move in with you. After all, it's just the workings of karma, all part of the grand illusion. So I could go on, but you get the point there? Like often we use spiritual rationalization, don't we? To think we have this image of ourselves as being the spiritual person, that we're transcended all this stuff. But is it true? Probably not, right? It's okay to have our humanity. It's okay to be annoyed if somebody got the promotion that you wanted, right? So it's really, the book's really about embracing our humanity, embracing ourselves just as we are, not having spiritual pretenses, because that's just gonna create a disconnection. A disconnection is going to cause suffering, a disconnection from who we really are. Okay. So many sections I like to read to you. Would you like to hear about longing? Oh. I see focusing, by the way, as a practice of loving kindness toward ourselves, really being gentle with ourselves. Okay. Okay, here's an exercise you can practice. The next time you feel angry or frustrated with a loved one, take some time to sit quietly with yourself. Notice how you're feeling beneath your frustration or disappointment. Is there some longing that's painfully unmet? Perhaps a yearning for kindness, closeness, or caring? If so, take some time to gently hold that tender place, that tender longing within yourself. I mean, it raises the question, how do we relate to longing? How do we relate to longing? Do we have aversion to it? What do you long for? Maybe take a moment right now, just notice, you know, what are you longing for in your life? Is it okay to have, let me just go inside for a minute. You won't have to share this with anyone. Just notice what you're feeling in there. Maybe understanding, connection, kindness, love, intimacy. And just see what spontaneously arises. What does it feel like in your body? Is it okay to have it? It's okay to allow yourself to experience it. Is it painful to experience it? Or is it kind of pleasant to experience it? Notice what happens as you just let yourself have it. Okay, so don't feel obligated, if anybody wants to share what that was like, it might help others to hear that. I know it's a very personal, vulnerable kind of thing, so don't feel obligated to share it. But what I'm trying to help you get to is just to really honor your human longing, that it's okay to have it and to make space for it sometimes, because if we get clear what we're longing for, we're more likely to be able to move forward and move toward that in our life, to create that in our life. Does that make sense? What do you think of that? Yeah. Is it difficult? Is it difficult for anyone to just allow yourself to?
It hurts.
Yeah.
I feel like a poster child in my life for sitting and following this advice and staying with rawness and staying with pain. And it's very sobering that doesn't make it go away. And so that the challenge seems to be, how do you really find a way to be okay? That's your authenticity.
Right.
I suppose that you could say, and sometimes I feel that way, well, it's the truth, and the truth is better than less truth. But it's a conundrum. It's very challenging to feel into your longing and to have it be painful and then not to feel shame around it.
Yeah, to not feel shame around it. That's such a key part of it, to allow yourself to have the longing. And
it just doesn't feel right. Like our humanity, pain, it's like I feel like we're programmed to not feel
pain. We're programmed to not feel
pain.
Right,
to feel pain. It's like mammalian, not good stuff to feel pain, right?
Right.
But if that tends to be what you're going through,
if we happen to be going through
the species,
if we happen to be going through pain, you're saying allow ourselves to feel it, to have it, not to avoid it, not to have aversion to pain. I mean, this is a very
all those things you're saying right there, right?
Yeah, this to me is like the core of the Buddhist path, is living your life without clinging or aversion, just letting
It
sounds great. It's a practice. It takes practice. That's why it's called a practice.
Beethoven, piano concerto or something. It really is a skill. But,
yes.
I mean, we can talk about
Why we call it a practice. You don't have to be perfect at it. It's a skill. And this is where focusing can be really helpful, to be with our experience, to share it with others who might be able to listen, to open our heart, and to connect. And you know what? Another way to talk about it, if we can share more of our feelings with each other, it's like taking refuge in the Sangha. I mean, that's one of the three refuge vows, taking refuge in the Buddha, in the Dharma, which is the truth, how things are, taking refuge in the Sangha, in the community of people who are on the spiritual path. So to be able to share our feelings, too, with each other, to me, is a really important part of the path. Yeah. Is that painful for other people to do? I feel bad now that I created so much pain for people to do that exercise. Was it painful? Was it illuminating at all? Did it feel good in some way? Yeah? Is it okay? Okay. Helpful? Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Good question. I'd like a little clarification about the scenario you gave with the person, the meditator who gets up in the morning and goes through all his routines and he's really annoyed that the coffee's not ready and someone else.
No, he's not annoyed that the coffee.
He's not.
No, he's not
he's
annoyed.
He's not annoyed that.
Because he's living this totally serene life.
And he's not annoyed that somebody else got the job.
Right, he's not annoyed that someone else got the job. Right, that's what that was about.
Okay, I got the impression he was annoyed.
No, no, he's not.
Those feelings.
No, he's. Yeah, well, that's the point in this giving the story, that he's denying all those feelings, those human feelings.
Yeah, well, that he really is at a certain level annoyed and.
Yes.
And
yeah. On a certain level, he really is. I would speculate that yes.
He resents not getting the job. I just want.
Yeah. I mean, that's my take, and I created the story so I can interpret it any way I want. Right. It's the advantage of writing a book. You can make up stories and then interpret them.
Yeah.
But I see this man as like a typical person who's avoiding his feelings and his humanity. So he has an image of himself as being a spiritually transcended person.
Yeah.
You know people like that. Anyone know people like that? Did you used to be? I used to be kind of like that, you know, so I can really relate to it. You know, I thought being spiritual means you're in this certain kind of state continually, you're in bliss, you're happy, you don't have these fears, you don't have these pesky feelings that are coming up. And I see this a lot in my therapy practice. People come in and say, oh, I'm such a bad meditator, you know, I'm not a very spiritual person because I really felt angry toward my partner. And you know, I try to disabuse them of that and say, no, it's all part of being human, just to feel what you feel. It's fine. And let the feeling be there as long as it wants to last. You don't have to get over it so quickly. Just let it have its life and see where it goes. Just trust the process. That make sense? So to me, that's. I think we're kind of in a paradigm shift, really, where I think what's been happening in spiritual movements and communities is like a bias to avoid feeling, to avoid desire, to push away those uncomfortable feelings, or push away our desires. But what I'm saying in this book is that no, the spiritual path is all about embracing our feelings and embracing our desires and working with them in a skillful way. Because like the monk in the story, if we don't embrace them and work with them, we repress all those feelings. We're just clinging to some image of ourselves that's not realistic, which disconnects us. Disconnects us from ourselves, disconnects us from each other. So I'm kind of passionate about this point because I think it's really important for people on a spiritual path to learn that they need to not bypass, that's a common word used these days, not do the spiritual bypassing where they're bypassing their feelings. Mm-hmm. Where they're not doing what other Peter Campbell and Ed McMahon teachers are focusing, they call it process skipping. Process skipping is skipping over parts of your process that are uncomfortable instead of embracing them and working with them. So what I'm trying to make a really strong point on in this book is to embrace our humanity, embrace ourselves just as we are. Just embrace ourselves as we are. Tara Brach, I love her work, you know Tara Brach, the book Radical, she calls it Radical Acceptance. And to her, that's the core of the Buddhist path, is totally accepting ourselves as we are. Yeah.
So I have a question about, there's the other side of that dichotomy that you're drawing. You know, there's the spiritual bypass and the avoidance of actually confronting what really is arising in oneself. But the other side of that is there can be a kind of an indulgence in identification in the story of oneself and a kind of wallowing in the emotional reactivity that we find ourselves in. So I'm wondering how you ward against that in the same way that you ward against spiritual bypass
right.
In this methodology.
That's the next book. That's the next talk. So I've got to come back for that one. No, just joking. No, I address it in this book, actually.
Okay.
I mean, to me, there's a middle path. You know, in the middle way, just being with felt experience just as it is. Not amplifying it, not exaggerating it, not intensifying it, and not minimizing it. So it takes practice. It's a practice to work that path where we just let ourselves just be with the experience just as it is, not letting our mind amplify it, not you know, maybe noticing if we're having ideas about the feeling, like, oh, this relationship didn't work, it means I'm a failure, it means I'm never going to find love again. We scare ourselves with all these thoughts, and that amplifies the feeling. We get into our story then, I think is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's right. We get into like some story that just amplifies the painful feelings rather than just seeing things just as they are for what it is. It's just, you know, it's just sadness. It's pain. If you say a relationship ends that you were attached to, you feel sad. So just be with that experience just as it is. Noticing how it is in the body too can be really helpful. just really being with the felt experience of the body, allows it to open, to shift, maybe it unfolds. It's an unfolding of meaning from the feeling as we stay with it. Bruce.
Stuart, you know, in focusing, and John's pointing at it, but there's a particular part of focusing that fascinates me. And it's called right distance, like finding the right distance from pain or the right distance from your experience, where you're close enough to be in touch with it, not so close that it gets you. And that, for me, is my response to what you're saying, is just finding, there seems to be a natural sense of right distance from things that people know instinctively inside of themselves.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
But, well, that's a question, is do they know it instinctively, or is that something that is an element of training?
Both, in my eyes.
Yeah. So let me read you another section here. I also have a section here on spiritual teachers. Has anybody been with a spiritual teacher? Or it's kind of a mixed bag, isn't it? I mean, I think we need teachers to learn, to grow, to open up. But if any of you have been with spirit, if you're willing to say, been with spiritual teachers, and you realize later it wasn't very helpful, you kind of maybe listen too much to them instead of listening to yourself. Can people relate to that? I've had experiences like that with spiritual teachers. I had one spiritual teacher tell me I should give up writing my dissertation when I was working on my PhD and just do my spiritual practice. You know, maybe he was right. Maybe I should have done it. Because now you guys are stuck with me talking about this stuff. But you can get really bad advice, right, from a spiritual teacher. We have to really learn how to listen to our own heart, listen to ourselves. It's really, really crucial. Okay, here's a section called Accepting versus Finessing Our Experience. Spiritual teachers often agree that liberation is always available if we're present enough to notice it. Have you heard that? Awakening, spiritual liberation, all we have to do is be aware of it. But the subtext is often being present shouldn't include being in too much pain. Being present shouldn't include being in too much pain. You're supposed to be calm or in bliss. Isn't that kind of the message in spiritual communities? You're supposed to be calm, supposed to be in bliss. I went to this meeting once, I talk about it in the book, where it was a spiritual gathering, and the woman asked me, how are you? And I said, oh, not too well today. I had a cold. And she said, well, why not? It's a beautiful day. You know, life is beautiful. Why aren't you okay? So I felt totally shamed by that. You know, well, God, I'm not a very good spiritual practitioner. And shortly thereafter, I learned she was one of the leaders of this spiritual gathering, right? So she had this belief of how you're supposed to be when you're a spiritual person. It doesn't welcome our humanity just as we are, right? It's very subtle, but it's so common in the spiritual communities that there's a certain way we need to be spiritual. It's very toxic. Okay. Or worse, if you have emotional stuff that's too painful, it means you're not very evolved. Just shift your perception and you'll discover who you really are, a being of pure light and unsullied awareness. Does that make sense? As a friend who's practiced Buddhism put it, the subtle implication is that if you have a persistent, tangled old feeling, it's kind of shameful, especially if you can't banish them quickly through spiritual practice. Does that sound familiar?
Oh my God, you're writing my autobiography.
Reading your autobiography, you see. I mean, isn't that so common? We take that on. We're not being spiritual if we have these human things. And I say here, it'd be wonderful if through some sleight of hand, we could instantly connect with our spiritual essence and realize that we're having an unhelpful thought or ill-advised feeling that is causing suffering. Right? I mean, indeed, if we're caught in a destructive thought loop, remembering the beauty of who we are might sometimes help. But it's usually more complex than that. We also need to find a way to be with the feelings that are gripping us before a tighter, anxious place can shift inside us. Okay, so you're laughing. And did you want to say something about this?
It's just so, you know, when something is just described so perfectly. Where
describes you perfectly.
Okay. Yeah, like this whole spiritual persona can become this. I mean, it's tyrannical. I've experienced it.
Yes, that's a good word for it.
In the face of pain or the face of difficulty, it just it just what you just read there, it's just it's like a demon that's gone off inside.
Right.
And it's cloaked
the spiritual
in all
self
this language.
It's cloaked in this language, right?
It's
but it's a tyrannical demon
that's punishing you for not living up to this particular
standard of what a spiritual person is supposed
exactly.
to be.
You just read
right.
off the standard.
Right.
That's
right.
Left.
Right.
That's
right.
So right on.
It resonated.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Did it resonate for anybody else? So that she doesn't feel so alone, please.
I need to be validated.
Yes.
What I find a little frustrating
is
I'm sure we've all had
I can relate to it.
We've all had experiences of having a big shift. I had one the other day where I was complaining about something and something came up and somebody described how their friends child had leukemia come back, and it's completely wiped out all this other, stuff I was feeling, and made it like fade away and go, oh, well, things are okay with me. And there are other times, like when those shifts do happen sometimes, where it's not that, if you're clinging on to your boss giving the job to somebody else, every once in a while it really can just disappear by a shift in attitude.
Right, but I think first you need to honor the feelings.
Sure.
It's the first place. And a lot of people don't take the time to pause and honor their feeling. I mean, that's the way it's going to shift. If you honor that that's how you're feeling, and then you can get some perspective.
Right.
Not to cling to or hold on to, I'm angry and I'm justified in being angry and creating a whole story around that. So it's a middle path. It's
just frustrating sometimes because you know that sometimes there's a fast path that happens that relieves suffering or relieves, turning around something, and sometimes you just have to sit with it for a while, and I think, oh, I must be doing something wrong, because the fast path isn't coming. It should be there all the time.
Yeah, I think that's the way we get into trouble. We think there's a fast path we should be able to be on if we're really a spiritually evolved person. We should work with these feelings, and they should transmute or pass very quickly. They might, but they might not.
Right.
And then we need to be with them, process them, focus on them, share them with the friends. I get by with a little help from my friends, say the Beatles, right?
It was about drugs.
What?
Drugs.
No, it was about drugs.
If all else fails, try drugs.
Really?
Yeah. Anyone else who hasn't spoken yet, have any comment and question, and then I'll come back to you. Yeah, Freya.
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm going to get thrown out on the street for saying this, but I've never really tried to be a spiritual person.
Really?
It feels inauthentic to me.
Well, congratulations. I think that's great. And I talk about this in the book, that some of the most... I'm sorry, go ahead, continue.
Yeah, I have explored spiritual practices at times, and I've read a lot of, world religion material, but somehow, the striving to be spiritual... inauthentic.
Right.
So I just don't.
The striving to repeat, because it's for the tape here.
Yes.
The striving to be spiritual is inauthentic. So
yes.
You haven't been striving to be a spiritual person. You're striving to be a human person, maybe. And maybe not even striving, but your practice is to be human.
Yeah.
And one thing I mentioned in the book is, to me, some of the most spiritually evolved people would not consider themselves as spiritual at all. If you call the most kind, caring, compassionate people, they don't consider themselves spiritual necessarily. They're just doing what they do because that's part of being human. Right? Does that make sense, what she's saying there? Yeah.
And I think I thought for many years that there was something that was missing,
mm-hmm.
because I wasn't striving.
Ah, you thought for many years something was missing because you weren't striving
right.
for this kind of spiritual perfection.
Right.
Yeah.
But then, I don't know. The last
2 or 3 years it shifted, and you're just letting yourself be who you are.
Yeah. Into, I guess, the radical acceptance.
Into more radical acceptance of just what is. Yeah, I think that's the path. Does that make sense? I think it's simple. Just really being with our experience as it is inherently a spiritual... To me, spirituality is... The word spirit comes from the word breath. To me, it means life, connecting with life. The being with life as it's unfolding from moment to moment. And that includes feelings that we're having. Being with that, embracing it, not clinging to them, but just giving them space, being spacious around them, see where they go, share them.
I do want to say that I do have the feeling, just to be honest with the feeling that's arising, that there's a sense of a straw man being created around spiritual, and the sense of that, because when we have an identity about being spiritual,
yes,
when we create this persona about being spiritual, and we've seen lots of people who do that, I mean, that's within the context of most legitimate, what I would call legitimate spiritual traditions, that is a well-known kind of mode. Trungpa referred to it as spiritual materialism,
right,
where you created the spiritualized ego. And what you say about acceptance, and what you say about being present to feelings that we have, in my experience, is something that's sort of intrinsic with what,
right,
often, you know, deep spiritual traditions actually teach.
Uh-huh.
And so you know, I want to,
yeah,
be careful not to, as it were, throw the baby out with the bathwater.
So authentic spiritual traditions will teach us to be with our feelings, to have a relationship with the feelings, you're saying? To,
yes,
to honor them. Just let them be,
yeah,
as
I mean,
they are. Be mindful of mindfulness of feelings in Buddhism. It's one of the four foundations of mindfulness, right? Mindfulness of body, mindfulness of feelings, to really allow them to be as they are. So that is the core of the practice, but a lot of people miss it.
That is a core of the practice.
Sure.
I won't go so far as to say that's the only
okay,
core of the practice,
okay,
but what I want to differentiate that from is this idea that many of us have experienced, where you're striving because you have this projection about being perfect,
right?
And that's more about us and about us as Westerners interpreting spiritual traditions more than what the lineages of those teachings are actually trying to point to.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I was just sort of reflecting on the gentleman behind me that heard about his friends. I guess it was a daughter or something with leukemia that sort of shifted him out of his predicament. I'm wondering if what happened, he probably knows better than us, if he felt compassion, you know, when he heard that, and that shifted him out of his head into his heart.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering where the heart plays in this. In other words, in my personal experience, I feel a lot of what happens is when I start to get too much into my head analyzing things, that just by shifting down into the heart where we associate with feelings, that just centers me and puts things in perspective.
Yeah.
About where does the heart fit in this?
Yeah, the shifting into, well, to me the heart is being present in your experience just as it is, connecting with your body. I mean, my understanding of Chinese philosophy, mind and heart are very close. So to just really be present. Did you want to respond to that?
Well, just to insert something, I read, and I can't remember now who wrote it sometime in the past year, that the translation of the word mindfulness isn't really an accurate translation, but that it's really more heartfulness.
Mindfulness, the better translation is heartfulness, you're
and
saying.
And that
mm-hmm.
by whoever first translated it as mindfulness, it sort of
right.
sent us off on a little bit of a misleading path.
Yeah, Dogen, the Zen master, talks about soft-heartedness as being a core of the practice. He uses that word a lot. I talk about him in the book, his soft-heartedness. I like that term.
And mindfulness can sound really intellectual.
It does,
and
yeah, it can.
Rationalizing
it can.
And can feed into a whole other
right.
thing.
Right. Yes. It's true. That's a really good point. I'm noticing that time's moving on. Uh-huh.
I'd like to bring in the function of community in resolving distress and things that are coming up for us. Like I've noticed that when I'm struggling with something and I ask someone for help in a really clear way, that the help comes from inside of me. Sometimes
mm-hmm.
the person doesn't have to do it, but the importance of there being somebody there who I can go to and say, I'm struggling with this.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, the importance of being with someone, if you're struggling with something, you can go to them and tell them that, is really, really important and powerful.
Right, right. And also when you're seeing somebody struggling with some with something like I had this really great experience down at Spirit Rock when I went down there to pick someone up after a workshop, and this woman was running around frantically, hectically. She had misplaced or lost her computer with all her life's work on it, you know. And I stopped her in the middle of all of her rushing about, and I bowed to her and I said, "I honor your distress." And she grabbed that moment. She knew to use that moment, and she bowed back to me. And then in that space, she remembered where it was.
Oh wow! You have calmer. You have calmer.
Nice.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a similar story in my book that I want to tell too. There was a woman who was giving birth. She was in labor, and she was in a lot of fear. And the midwife said to her, "You have nothing to be afraid of. Everything's fine." And she said, "But I am afraid." And then her husband went to her and said, "You know, dear, I really hear that you're afraid." And she immediately calmed down, gave birth to a beautiful baby, and everything worked out okay. And what really helped was that magical moment where her fear was just resonated with the person. Her husband could really understand that she's in fear, and that's okay, I understand, I hear you. So she felt a connection in that moment. And it goes back to what I said earlier, that often pain, often suffering is because of the feeling of disconnection. So it's so powerful when you go to a friend who's able to just really listen and be there. How does that feel? Isn't that wonderful? Doesn't that feel good? You don't want to hear, "How did you create that reality?" Right? That's not so helpful, right? You don't want to hear, maybe you don't even want to hear, you know, "This too will pass." Maybe that's a little better. But it's more powerful when someone is just with us in an empathic way, in a compassionate way, just really hearing us, hearing our sorrow. Maybe they can relate from their own. But I think it takes an ability to know our own sorrow, our own fears, to be present with the full range of our own feelings. Because the more we have depth in terms of what we're feeling and experiencing, then the more we're going to be able to connect with other people's feelings, with other people's sorrow. If we're constantly pushing away our own pain, we're not going to have very much empathy and compassion for other people's suffering. Make sense? So I always go back in the book between this dual path of being intimate with ourselves and being intimate with others. Like they really go hand in hand. Like being present with others, it's kind of like an interbeing kind of thing. The more we can be present with ourselves and honor the full range of what we feel, the more we can be present with others and just kind of be in that flow of being with our own experience, being with their experience, being present with others. And it's a beautiful path. It's a beautiful path to practice. So we'll get to the end of our time. Is it a good time to start to wrap up, or powers that be, say so? Any questions, comments before we stop? I wish we had more time. There's so much else I'd like you to hear about from the book. And I want to mention Bruce's workshop is also, if you want to learn about focusing, he's got flyers up on the table. He's a great teacher of focusing. I've learned a lot from Bruce. So I really encourage it, because you really learn a lot more about what's in the book, too, by learning focusing, isn't it? A lot of the book is really about focusing. It's really about connecting with our felt experience just as it is. So I really encourage that, to encourage you to consider learning focusing. It's a very powerful, gentle tool to be loving toward ourselves. Yeah. Bruce, you were going to say something?
Well, yeah, I was going to say something. I was with you a lot of that time when you were writing that book.
Uh-huh.
You did a beautiful job of it, and you're talking about it now has really matured. So I'm going to tell you how much I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Bruce. Appreciate that very much.
It's
true.
It's beautiful what you've done.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Well, I'm happy to hang out and chat or sign books if you'd like to pick one up. And that would support me. I would encourage you to take a look at it. That would support the bookstore.
Please buy
a book.
Support your local bookstore.
Support your local book. This is a great bookstore. I just love this store. We're so blessed to have this in the community. So,
thank you
so
on behalf of Many Rivers.
Well, thank you all.
for coming tonight. As you most of you know, we have a donation bowl over on the counter. We encourage you to contribute to it, which we share, the proceeds of which we share to help maintain this store and with our speakers to maintain their work. And as you see, the new book, many copies of the new book here, a couple copies of some of the older books. And I know that, as he's already said, John would be happy to sit, chat, inscribe, and other related activities for the next few minutes. So thank you again for coming to Many Rivers. We look forward to seeing you again in the future.
I'm sorry, it's not the...